Welcome to the sixth Curmudgeon Corner of 2007, or Curmudgeons, or Curmudgeons S with apostrophe, or one of the things we'll talk about is this time around. From the last episode, Greg responded with a post on his blog, Otherwise Occupied. And there are a few things that he mentioned that we'll talk about. And to talk about that, I have Greg Haverkamp with me today, rather than Yvonne Bo, who's having technical difficulties. So say hello, Greg.
Hello.
And one of the first things is, why is it Curmudgeon apostrophe S corner rather than Curmudgeon's apostrophe corner? And the only thing that I figure is that I'm the only curmudgeon.
Okay.
And then anybody else who's on is just whatever, you know, but I'm the curmudgeon. So there's
one curmudgeon. I thought that might be a possibility.
Of course, that's sort of retroactively explaining, and the actual reality is that I probably never thought of it before.
Clearly I hadn't either, and I was around for the original show, so go figure.
Exactly. So in any case, the main bulk of the post that you made responding to the last podcast was that I actually started talking about various things related to constitutional law, which, of course, I actually know very little about, whereas you've actually like taken classes in it. So, you know, you have some facts that I perhaps did not have in front of me and corrected me on all sorts of things.
Yes, although you did, of course, mention that you had everything correct in the part that you lost.
Of course. Absolutely everything was correct in the part of the episode that got zapped. And I stated everything much more eloquently and concisely and was able to make my point in a much more forceful and compelling way. Let's just hit a couple of the things. I'm trying to look through your post to the various most important parts. One was I'd used the example of the Congress shall establish no law, blah blah blah. You know the exact words better than I do. I don't have in front of them about freedom of the press and then extending it to the states. And I'd said that very early on this change had happened. And you, of course, mentioned that the actual date was, what was it, in 1916 or something?
I think it was 1925 when the first decision actually incorporated the First Amendment.
And see, all I have to say about that is that just. It all is about what you mean by fairly soon.
Yeah, or early on?
And I figure, or early on, and I figure 150 years is fairly soon, is early on, isn't it?
As I said, you know, I guess maybe it's early on relative to the 14th Amendment, which really turns constitutional law on its ear.
So talk about that a little bit in terms of what happened. That's one of the Reconstruction Amendments, right?
That is one of the Reconstruction Amendments. So the 14th Amendment has this due process clause, an additional due process clause. This actually makes it a lot of fun when you're studying this. So Article or 14th Amendment Section 5 then gives the Congress the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of the 14th Amendment. And so one of the things that they've done then is they've seized on Section 1, actually, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, which sets down a requirement that the states follow due process, and that as well equal protection to the states. And so what this did then was it was the first time that, well, the 13th Amendment, obviously, which outlawed slavery, and then the 14th Amendment, and then the 15th Amendment, which was suffrage for minorities, brought about this sea change of the Constitution directly applying, well, the amendments directly applying to the states. And then what happened was people seized on the due process notion. They said, okay, well, if we've got to worry about due process of the laws, and it's somewhat ambiguously stated what this due process notion means in the 14th Amendment, Well, does that mean that we can start to look at due process as part of the rest of Bill of Rights? And does that mean that we should start applying the Bill of Rights to the states? And the answer early on was, well, we don't really know, probably not. And then eventually that changed, as these things tend to do. And what they started doing was they started picking out individual sections of the Bill of Rights, individual amendments from the Bill of Rights, and actually individual components of the Bill of Rights, and actually applying them in a piecemeal fashion in a process that's called incorporation. And so I'm sorry, that was kind of a long dialogue, but that's...
That's quite all right. But now, going through this process, and a lot of this has to do with the gradual buildup of precedent, correct? Because in most cases, you're not going to find an actual explicit legislative or constitutional statement that says this has now been applied in this other case as well.
No. I don't think there's a single amendment that actually says, you know, in reference to such and such a case. In fact, I'm quite certain there's not.
Well, no, I'm not saying that in that case. I'm saying, for instance, the principle of incorporation in general, it's not something that has ever, there was never explicitly a constitutional amendment that said, oh, and by the way, the terms of the Constitution will apply to the states as well as in terms of those limitations in these cases. Instead, or not in these cases, but just in general saying, for instance, oh yeah, First Amendment, the state legislatures are bound by that as well.
No, that's correct. There was nothing. In fact, the legislative history, if for want of a better term, I guess, during the passage of the 14th Amendment is a little bit unclear on exactly what people meant by the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. And that's why, of course, early on when, people weren't really sure what to do with it, and it caused a great deal of debate on the matter. But we are where we are now, probably for a court, because we go through cycles. We've got courts like we've got now, which would like the court to not extend a whole lot. And then we've got courts like the Warren Court, which would like to, you know, see that they take proactive measures and do a lot of, I hesitate to say social engineering, because people would tell me that the Roberts Court is probably doing some of the same. But so I guess it's all a matter of perspective.
Which, of course, brings me back to sort of another big part of your comments, where I'd sort of stated I was a literalist, and you hung on the point where I said something along the lines of, the laws should say what they mean what they say, and you said, well, have you mastered the ability to interpret all of these vague things that are always passed all the time? And so just to clarify my glib statement, I certainly think that interpretation in cases where laws are vague or ambiguous is indeed a proper role of the courts. Where I get into my literalist mode is where the literal words do not seem to be ambiguous, but seem to be fairly straightforward. When the courts nevertheless try to interpret them in a much broader fashion than the actual words would seem to indicate. That's where I sort of get a little bit hung up. And even in the case, and I should say, in many of the cases where the actual wording is ambiguous, I think the courts are there put in a position where they have to interpret because there's no other choice. But the problem is the ambiguity in the first place, and the right way to address it is to re-legislate and address the ambiguity.
Yes, well, I understand. I mean, the problem is that certainly when you talk about the First Amendment, even there is considerable discussion about, well, what does speech mean, right? You look up speech in the dictionary, and it will tell you that speech is, an audible sound, meaning articulated by audible sounds or something. So that's really kind of the problem.
So of course, if you were to interpret that strictly literally and without any opportunity to change what it actually said originally with another amendment to enhance it, then all sorts of things that weren't speech but were expression would not be protected in the slightest. So the way that it has evolved over the years is that people have interpreted speech broadly, as opposed to going back and saying, okay, we need another amendment to say we didn't mean just speech.
Right. I mean, part of the beauty of the system, that with how it's kind of built, is the fact that we don't amend the Constitution
very often.
Very often. I was going to say, you know, we don't amend it on a whim, but then we do have the whole prohibition era. But
although that took a while, it wasn't quite a whim. It built up over quite a period of time before they got enough support to do that.
Yes, that's true. But still, that. It feels like it had to have been, you know, I can't transport myself back to that time, but you just tried to think about even the energy building up to do that. I don't know if alcoholism was rampant or what, but maybe I should do more reading on the lead up to that. But I think the other problem is that nobody really talks about, you know, it's this whole freedom of speech. And so not only do you have the speech problem, but what does it mean to have freedom of speech? And you know, that's where you get these ambiguities. And on the one hand, it would be great if we could literally interpret all this stuff. But of course, even the most ardent originalist on the court today wouldn't try to do much literal fixing, as you know, as much as just looking for the original meaning, which tends to be the most conservative of the approaches on the court, anyway.
Yeah, and I tend to have the literalist streak, not just in terms of this, but in terms of everything. And, you know, it causes me problems all the time. You know, somebody recently, I had my XM radio on in the car, and somebody wanted to change me to change a channel and told me to hit the button, so I punched it really hard and broke it. And to this day, it's no longer affixed to the car properly because I broke the hinging because they told me to hit the button. So, you know, this is not something unique to my interpretation of law.
Right. Kill the light, Jaime.
Exactly. So, but yeah, I do tend to, every time I look at one of these arguments, I do tend to have a strong preference towards looking at the literal interpretation, if it's at all viable.
Well, I don't think there's anything invalid in that, and that's certainly not my wasn't my complaint. I mean, certainly one should look to the words themselves first to see if they make sense. The problem is that it's very difficult to actually make sense of this. So it's not like they gave us a lexicon with the Constitution, right? So,
right.
Or at least they didn't give us a defined lexicon. They did give us one.
Right.
You know, and
but
so what does it mean to abridge the freedom of speech? Well, what the hell is the freedom of speech?
Right. But at the same time, I think you can see a very clear movement where the interpretation over the years drifts further and further from the plain reading you interpret the nuances and say, well, maybe it means this, that's a little bit broader, maybe it means that. And as you go through individual cases that test the limits, it does move over time, so that in the end, in many of these situations, I think you end up in a place where how it's being interpreted today would be unintelligible to the folks who originally wrote it.
Oh, unquestionably. Unquestionably. And of course, if you believe a lot of what you read about the history of it, you know, they wouldn't even give speech, they wouldn't take the literal meaning of speech as you put it. I mean, there's a certain set, certainly of the originalist, side of the argument that would say that the original meaning of speech as defined in the Constitution was really political speech. And
right.
If you're not making political statements, then you don't really have any freedom whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, the drift in interpretation is obviously something that in many times has been hailed as, you know, one of the positive aspects in terms of how it can evolve over time and meet the needs of the moment, as opposed to being stuck in, you know, 1780, whatever it was. And that is a potential strength. I just think that at certain points we're it at certain points when the interpretation gets far enough from the language, it really is the best thing to change the language. And at that point, it's necessary not to continue trying to interpret something in such a tortured way to get the result you want, even though, you know, just reading the plain language, that's not what it says.
I think you're right, and I think probably the hesitation, I think there's a certain amount of reverence that's given the First Amendment, and I think the notion of amending the First Amendment probably scares a great number of people.
Oh, and I certainly would not take that lightly either, and I'd sort of, you know, if I was personally looking at a potential amendment to the First Amendment, I would only consider supporting it in the slightest if it expanded it rather than contracted it. But the problem is, of course, that with such things, you have to be very careful because you can very often have unintended consequences from a change.
That's right. You'll end up right down the road that we're at now with the First Amendment.
Right. So I think we've covered most of that. So let's move on quickly. You had a topic also in the legal vein that you wanted to mention quickly.
Well, we can just we can hit this and then go from what we have. So I've been researching this area now for months, which is, what are your Fourth Amendment protections when it comes to interception of your internet communications? And in this case, interception would be real-time law enforcement surveillance of your communications on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has generally been a purely theoretical area of the law. There haven't been many court challenges to it because there is no statutory exclusionary rule. So courts are not required in any way to keep this from being considered in evidence, even if a law enforcement agency breaks the law and surveils you in this way. Anyhow, on Friday, a big decision came down in the Ninth Circuit in a case called U.S. v. Forrester, where they actually considered, in this case, what the dimensions were of the so-called PIN register statute and what it allows a law enforcement agency to collect without a probable cause warrant. And their answer was largely that a PIN register, which was originally a purely analog device that took the pulses from, you know, pulse-style phones and recorded the pulses to track the numbers that you were dialing.
Right.
And so what they've done is they've gradually expanded the meaning of PIN registers as we've moved from old-style dialing like that through electronic dialing. And now, for the first time, the Ninth Circuit has said that the PIN register statute actually allows for the collection of to and from email addresses while sending emails, as well as IP addresses of other internet traffic, such as visiting websites.
So basically what it is saying is that the information that regards what you're doing without the content itself, so sort of the traffic information, I'm sending email to you, you're sending email to me, I'm looking at these websites, right now I'm doing a voice chat with you, the sort of information that those things are happening, they can retrieve without a warrant, but not necessarily the content of the conversation that we're having. Is that correct? Or
certainly the PIN register statute does not allow for the collection of the content. So that is correct. Really, the area that I'm most interested in, not necessarily for this conversation, but the area that I'm fleshing out as part of my research for school is, where does the content line begin?
Right.
And in the Ninth Circuit would say that, well, with an email, the content line begins after you got that blank line following the message, the RFC 822 message headers.
Okay.
Now, I fundamentally disagree with that notion as it applies to email. And certainly the...
Why don't you explain a little bit in terms of what pieces of content... So you're saying essentially there's content in the headers that you think should also be protected?
Well, I think it's important to look at you know, what you're doing when you send an email. I find it to be a somewhat disjointed decision, because on the one hand, it's saying that if I go to a web server and download a page, all I can collect if I'm a law enforcement agent is the IP address of that web server that I went to.
So not even the URLs, for instance, of the individual pages.
I presumably can't look at the HTTP headers or the HTTP commands I issued.
Right.
However, if I'm sending email, they make a couple of flawed assumptions. First, they're saying I necessarily avail myself of a third-party service if I send email on the internet. Well, that's just factually incorrect. Because certainly, now I don't run my own mail server anymore, but I used to.
And lots of people do.
And you still do, right?
I use Chris's.
Okay, so you're...
But I use a private mail server that is an individual, but it's a third party to me, but it's the point's still valid. Lots of people run private email servers that
right.
are not buying a service from someone else or utilizing someone else's service.
So let's say we exclude you and we include Chris, since Chris does run his.
Right.
If I send mail to Chris, what's going to happen is that my mail server, assuming I'm using SMTP directly to my mail server and bumping over to his, then I'm going to send to my mail server, which is going to send directly to his, and there's going to be no third party involved in that communication between me and Chris.
Well, could you make an argument that you are involving the third parties that own the intermediary routers?
But if you make that argument, then you also have to go back and look at the seminal case on this topic, which is US v. Katz, which established the reasonable expectation of privacy in a telephone communication, and say that, well, I'm involving a third party anytime I make a telephone communication, because there's always a series of phone lines that I'm speaking over.
Right.
And if we assume that Katz is still law, good law, and by all accounts it seems to be good law,
which says that basically while those third parties may technically in some way be quote-unquote involved, they're not involved in a substantial way to change the expectation that you're engaging in a one-on-one transaction.
That's right, because the way that we got to the PIN register statute, and where the PIN register statute says that it's not a violation to collect this information without a warrant, is that the Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called U.S. v. Miller, which led to a case called Smith v. Maryland. Now, in U.S. v. Miller, what you had was an instance of a person going to the bank and filing their stuff at the bank with their bank records and everything. And so that because those bank records were given to the bank, they were, released to a third party, and the bank could be subpoenaed for that information. In Smith v. Maryland, that was the first PIN register decision. And they said, well, look, since when you dial a phone number, you necessarily turn that phone number over to a third party, and you know that the third party records the phone number as a regular course of their business, and they're required to have it to do what they're supposed to do, then you don't have an expectation of privacy in the phone number, but Katz still holds, and you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the content of your communications.
Right.
Now, my argument would be that when you then move that to an email perspective, that you're not turning over the email addresses to, even if you're using a third-party provider, but certainly if you're using a private provider, but there's no distinction made in this realm as far as that goes. But if you're using a third-party provider, they don't need that email address to route your email, right? They only need the domain name that you're sending to,
mm-hmm.
so that they can go up and look up the next hop along the way. So even arguing that the email address is equivalent to the phone number is somewhat flawed, because all they really need is, the equivalent of the phone number, which is the domain name, so that they can look up the mail exchanger records. But I would even take it a step further, because keep in mind right now, based on how the law currently works, is that they could actually snoop the traffic that with you sending. If let's say you send you make SMTP communications directly with a mail server that you run, they could actually snoop your traffic directly to your own server.
Right.
Because they've already made this assumption that you're turning your email address over to a third party, and that, more importantly, that an email address is a communications facility, if you will. That's actually what they've what they did in the Patriot Act was they defined that an email address is a communications facility.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they didn't do it in the Patriot Act, but it's in the congressional testimony. And so what happens now is that they can actually snoop who you're sending mail to from your client, even if you're talking directly to your own mail server. And they can take action based on that.
Right.
And so my argument is that, and this is what I'm fleshing out, and it's actually what's been giving me some headaches, is that the communication that you're actually making on the internet when you send the email is the actual SMTP dialogue. Because that's something that you can go and do yourself,
right?
Because what's happening is your client is opening up the TCP connection, your desktop, your computer, or what have you, and then the mail program is actually just acting as a proxy on your behalf and issuing the SMTP commands and transporting the message across the net. And so, in essence, you could do that if you wanted to. You could go and sit there and type in SMTP commands to the other side. And so, therefore, that is actually part of your communication. The fact that the program is doing it has nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even see the divide there between that aspect of things, opening up the TCP connection, which would be very difficult for you to do as a human without the help of having a bunch of APIs and everything that take care of it, and the phone. Because obviously when you speak into a phone, it's the electrical signals that they can't record, but you're not speaking in electrical signals. When you speak on the phone, right? I mean, it's being converted from your analog voice into a bunch of electrical signals. So anyway, that's my place on that. And what we had in the decision in the U.S. v. Forrester was a court taking the position that has been the most prevalent decision or the most prevalent means of or method of analysis of this issue in the literature by the noted professors who actually work in this area. And they basically implemented just what they said should be the case. My argument is that those people have all been overlooking the actual technical details of how email works on the internet.
So real quick, and we've only got about 2 minutes left before we have to stop. But from the point of view of what they can actually do or not do, what differences would you think should be in place?
My personal view is that the most equivalent to a PIN register, since that's the last time we actually have a Supreme Court decision, is going to be looking at the transport layer. And so the law enforcement should be able to look no further into the communication than the transport layer.
So, for instance, they should be able to tell that I'm making a communication with Comcast, but not which Comcast user I'm making that communication to, because that's part of the next layer up.
Yes, they should be able to look at the IP addresses on either end.
Right.
And given where PIN register jurisprudence is now, I'd say they should probably even be able to look at the number of bytes that you actually send in the process during the course of those individual TCP sessions.
Right. Okay. Well, we are just about out of time, so I want to close up a bit. So thank you very much for joining me today, Greg. And
yep.
I get
bogged down in this stuff and I just can't stop talking.
That's quite all right. It is interesting stuff that potentially has some very large impact. It's just all about exactly how much and how far the government can operate without too many checks and balances. And it's a very interesting balance, but a very important one. Anyway, we are out of time. As usual, any questions or comments, please email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. And that's it for today's Curmudgeon's Corner. And we will be back next week talking about other things. Thank you again, Greg.
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Bye, everyone.